Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is tea time. Miss Liz is here, and we have a special guest in the house. Today I have Shane Wilson, the storyteller. That's right. He's an author. He's a musician, and we have a few surprises. So stay tuned, because this tea is going to be a little different today. So I'm just going to do the disclaimer, and then I'm going to do a little intro of the incredible guest that I have sitting in the backstage, and then we will spill some tea and get to know Shane Wilson's TEA today. Disclaimer for Miss Liz's Tea Times live shows. Miss Liz, myself, is going live using StreamYard. Before leaving a comment, please grant StreamYard permission to see your name at StreamYard.com. Please be advised that the content brought forward for any Tea Time shows hosted by myself, Miss Liz, is always brought forward in good faith. However, may bring forward dialogue and opinions that are not representative of my platform. The facts and information are perceived to be accurate at the given time of airing. All Tea Time guests and audience participations are responsible for using their good judgment in taking any action that may relate to the discussion. The content brought forward may include discussions somewhere they may be emotionally at risk. It is significant to know that this show is engaging in discussion forums only to offer and inspire awareness and connection and is not providing therapeutic advice. If you have any discussions, any questions about this disclaimer or the panelist discussion, you may freely contact me, Miss Liz, through my email at bookingmissliz@gmail.com. Moving forward, should you choose to voluntarily participate in this show in any aspect, I myself, Miss Liz, welcomes you. Should you decide that the show is not made for you at this time, I respect that and will see you at a later show at a later date. Now we got that disclaimer out of the way. Now let's do a little intro. I'm going to bring Shane in, and I'm just going to do a little mini intro, and then you can check out his full bio on Miss Liz's Facebook page. So I'm going to bring Shane in. So a little bit on Shane Wilson. So Shane Wilson is a storyteller. No matter the medium, the emphasis of his work is on the magical act of the story and how the stories we will immortalize us and give voice to the abstractions of human experience. His first two contemporary fantasy novels, as well as a stage play set in his world of Muse Universe, are currently available. And for his full bio, you can check it out on Miss Liz's Facebook page or my Linktree. So welcome, 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 Shane. Thank you for joining me today for tea.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I just move along like a little jelly bean here, just a flow. So Shane, so how did it all start, the storytelling?
I think that the best answer that I've come up with for this, and something that I'm asked frequently, and for a long time, the answer always sort of shifted, you know, like it's kind of a moving target, and it got further and further back in my history. Every time I would talk about it, I would sort of unlock another like part of it. And I think that it's just that my family was full of storytellers, and my mom and dad grew up in sort of the foothills of Alabama, in very blue collar sort of families with not a lot of entertainment options, right? Like they did not immediately have television, things like that. And so they resorted often to stories to sort of fill the time. And so I grew up around that. My grandfather, especially on my mom's side, was just a very good storyteller. He had such a way with words and sort of capturing these sort of like, you know, old wives tales, tall tales about things that definitely really happened, but definitely not the way that he would talk about them, you know. But it was just a way that would capture the attention of a young mind, you know. And I was always struck by that. I would always ask family members to tell me stories about whatever. You know, my dad would always tell these really great stories about when he was a kid and, you know, just the shenanigans that he would get in when he's trying to make his own fun. You know, the time that he was in a, he was playing a duel, you know, with one of his friends with live rounds, and he shot himself in the leg. Ooh. And I think he didn't know that the gun was loaded or something. He was just a dumb kid. They set a cornfield on fire one time, and this old woman thought that the world was ending. You know, like just good old country fun, you know? And and so I, when I was in the fifth grade, my grandfather that was so good at storytelling and so compelling to listen to had a stroke, and he sort of lost a lot of his ability then to tell those stories that we loved so much, and would often get frustrated with like trying to recall certain facts or names of people and things like that. And it was a sort of an eye-opening moment to see that happen even as a child, because I had grown up witnessing the power of the oral tradition, how powerful these oral stories can be passed down from generation to generation. Yeah. But I also in that moment recognized how that stuff is so temporary, that the oral tradition depends on being passed down because there's not a written record of it. And so I think that that's what maybe gravitate toward the written word a little bit more maybe than the oral tradition. And then like on a much more kind of like mechanical level, my parents were always super supportive. They bought me a typewriter when I was a kid. I learned how to spell on it. And just that sort of like the mechanical nature of that process of sitting down in the chair in front of the typewriter and going to work and pecking the keys. And like, I would ask my mom how to spell words and she would read them off to me. And I would just like hunt and peck when I was like a little kid, you know.
I love the pecking of the old typewriters, right? Yeah. The sound of them like.
For sure. Yeah. There's something pretty therapeutic about that. Cathartic, I guess. But yeah, I mean, so like that's sort of where it all began. And then, you know, formal education in elementary, middle school and high school, they did their best to make me fall out of love with it, you know, with just assignments that didn't resonate with me or whatever. And then I kind of came back around. I was writing really bad poetry when I was in middle school to try to like hit on girls. You know,
the little love letters that we passed.
Right. Yeah. I've still got all of that stuff around here somewhere. It will only see the light of day after I die. You know, it's all really bad, but that was always a part of me, right? Like I was always like in it, like doing that sort of stuff, practicing it or whatever. And then, in college it received a little bit of refinement, and then, you know, there you go. From there we get to here. Sorry, that was a long answer.
No, that was awesome. I love it. I love storytelling. I come from a blue collar family too. So we always had the moonshining stories, right? On how the great grandpa made the good old moonshine and stuff like that.
Yeah, you can't write down moonshine stories because, you know, that would create a paper trail. So.
Yeah, and we can't do that. We can't have those trails, nope. Right? So you started writing at what age, Shane?
So the very first, story that I really remember writing was in second grade. I wrote this story about this big scary dog that lived in the neighborhood, and like he stepped to me when I was on my bike, and he like blocked my path home, and so I threw my bike in the ditch and cut through the neighbor's yard and ran home that way. And so I wrote some fictionalized version of that where the dog was bigger and scarier, and I drew a cover. I like designed a cover for it. I put it all in this like folder and like bound it, you know? So like it was, that is the first artifact that would represent like my first like real attempt at story making, I guess, which is a little different than storytelling.
So what is the difference
in story making and storytelling? I don't know what the difference is, because, well, I think that when you're storytelling, you're talking only about the narrative, right?
Okay.
The narrative itself. I think when you're story making, you're considering all of the other things, like the myriad of other factors that go into that, right? And that is presentation, visual aesthetic. These are choices that you don't always think are important when you're putting a novel together, but font style, spacing, cover design, all this stuff is incredibly important. And all of that goes into like story making, right? Because you're now making something that someone can hold, as opposed to just telling someone a story.
Yeah. And there is a lot of aspects of writing a novel and putting a book together. Yeah. It's not just words on paper. There's a lot of things that you have to really,
absolutely.
You know, it's like making a jar of jam, right? You got to put the right sugar in. You got to put the right, you know,
that's right.
So I noticed that in your bio that you have a couple novels out. Could you share with the viewers and listeners out there what the name of the novels are?
Yeah, so the very first novel that I ever wrote is called A Year Since the Rain. And it is a contemporary fantasy story about a guy who is going through some like personal grief and trauma over the loss of his, the unexpected loss of his father and the loss of his significant other, one to death, one to leaving, like unannounced. And he then just decides to like bear down and just sort of like stick in his ways, right? Like this is just, he's just, you know, this is the way that he's going to cope with this is by just kind of like bearing down. All around him, the world begins to fall apart. And it's largely because of his own refusal to make any sort of personal progress or yeah, strike out on his own. He meets this woman that sort of helps him through all of that. Her name is Nona, and she is how I have sort of reimagined the muses. You mentioned the world of muses.
Yeah.
Is this sort of extended universe that I'm writing in. It's all of the novels connect, but they are all also like standalone stories. You can read any of them without having read anything else. They would totally make sense, but they do lock into each other like puzzle pieces, right? To reveal the full picture of what's going on in this world. The unifying conceit through the whole series is the idea of these muses that are based loosely on Greek mythology, that, you know, muses are the source of creative arts. But here I've reimagined them as like the source of inspiration in its many forms, not just creative.
And really good fantasy, really good journey, like a really good journey, right? Like an adventure.
Yeah, so like contemporary fantasy is like a light version of fantasy. It doesn't have a lot of the same sorts of things that we think of when we hear the word fantasy. No, there aren't dragons and knights, and like the world that it's set in is even very similar to the one that we live in.
Okay.
It's like if you were to look at our world through a funhouse mirror, it looks very familiar, but there are a couple of things that feel a little different, you know? So okay, it's like if you were to set a story in this world and then just inject a few little elements of magic into it.
It's almost like Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good example. Where, you know, once she goes through the mirror, then she's in this like wild place, which does happen sometimes in these stories as well, where like there's this other side that exists that some of the characters come from or go to. But by and large, I'm interested in like very realistic characters and very realistic settings, and then putting them up against these kinds of magical forces to see what weird things happen when you do that. I think that the ability to inject magic into a story like this sort of dials up the drama a little bit, and it allows us to see something else about the human condition or human nature that we wouldn't necessarily see if it was just a realistic story, right? Like, because now people are dealing with more heightened emotions and you know, that sort of thing. And it reveals those sorts of moments reveal things about people, I think, that you don't necessarily get at in other genres.
Yeah. Well, I like that Alice in Wonderland kind of feel, right? Because it kind of opens the mind, right?
Yeah.
Is it possible? Could this really happen?
Yeah. You know? I mean, one major source of the magic in these books is dreams. All of the protagonists tend to have dreams or visions of some sort that the muses have to help them figure out, like what they mean and how to interpret them for themselves. Yeah, like the dream is sort of the other side of the mirror, right? That's the wonderland that we have to go into to harvest this information. So Alice in Wonderland, I think, is a good example.
Yeah. Well, that's what I get when I hear the word fantasy. I'm just like, oh, there we go. We're jumping.
Yeah.
We're going in the rabbit hole again, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of people think of Tolkien and like Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, that sort of stuff. But Alice in Wonderland absolutely is closer to what I'm writing than that stuff.
So is that the one that was made into a screenplay?
No. So I wrote a short story a little while ago that is called The Boy Who Kissed the Rain. And I adapted that not into a screenplay, but into a stage play.
Okay.
I wrote the short story. It won this award. And then I started doing some like entertainment writing for the paper in town, and they had me doing like theater reviews. I was a theater major for a little while in college. And so that's always sort of been a love, you know?
Yeah.
But I had not done anything in theater for a long time. And then I was going to see these plays and I was like, wow, you know, I wonder what it would be like to like write a play, right? Like, what is that? What is that process even like? And which is honestly, like, this is the question that I ask myself that gets me into, I don't want to use the word trouble, but it gives me a lot of work to do, because I'm always asking, like, what would it be like to do this, right? And then all of a sudden, here we go, learning how to play guitar or trying to write a full-length play or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I wrote this play, and then it was accepted into a local reading series where they do limited staging. So it's a staged reading of the play with very minimalist like costuming and set elements and lighting. And so it's like very scaled down. But it was still very cool to see, you know, these characters that I had written come to life and walk around and deliver the lines that I had written and sort of embody in a lot of ways the really cool this really cool story that I had written, which is kind of like a weird take on Romeo and Juliet. And it's like if Romeo and Juliet and Avatar, the one with the big blue people. If they had if those two movies had a baby, if those two stories had a baby, it would be this. Because
what it would look like.
Yeah, it's very much like forbidden love, like opposite sides of the track. But like their love is forbidden because they are two different like kinds of entities, right? Like she is a magical entity and he is a human person. And those two elements or those two forces just like don't fit together.
Yeah.
And so like, how do they navigate that?
It's almost like Star Trek, right? Where they had different aliens, joined together,
sure.
And then created a new identity. And
yeah, for sure. It is. So that's the stage play. And it really just started as a thought experiment. I didn't know that anything would come of it. But then I sent it. Well, I asked the publisher that I've been working with for a little while. I was like, hey, I wrote this like weird little play. Are you guys cool with, do you want to publish that? And they're like, yeah, send it over. Yeah. Well, it sounds good. So then that happened. And that's The Boy Who Kissed the Rain. Then the second novel is called The Smoke in His Eyes. And it's a music story, still has a muse. It's a more traditional take on the muses, where the muse here is helping him understand the source of his creative inspiration and understand how to mine that to make beautiful art. Because I tend to think that inspiration can look like a mess. Like it can be very overwhelming to the senses. And it gives it like, you get a shot of it and you're just like, oh my God, I've got to do something with this, but I don't know what to do with it. It's like, there's so much right there at the initial, like at the burst of the inspired moment. And so that's sort of what he's going through in that novel. And when he finds his muse, she helps him sort of unravel all of that chaos in order to find something beautiful.
So it sounds like you write a lot of great love stories.
Yeah, there's this, and there's an interesting, I think, exploration of different kinds of love, that all love isn't romantic or paternal, right?
Yep.
Or even platonic, right? Like there are certain, and I think that between artists especially, there can exist a love and an affection that looks to a lot of people like romantic love, because of the way that they connect with each other over their art. Like that's a very intimate thing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they want to like date each other or get married or anything like that. They just find each other in the art and they just live in that, you know?
Well, I think with the work that you do, Shane, you're actually making people look at words differently, you know? You kind of do like what I do with tea, you know, kind of play with the mind and all of that. Open the mind, because when people hear the word love, right away they think, you know, romantic, partnership,
right.
You know, but there's so many different types of love out there that we don't even pay attention to, you know, the love of a friendship, the love of communication, you know, there's so much different levels of it.
Yeah.
But as you're sharing, I hear the love stories, the mist and the romance and the connection.
In the Smoke in His Eyes, there's sort of two love stories that happen there with the protagonist. He, when he's in college, he starts to play music with this girl named Leela that he meets like in class. and she plays bass guitar. He plays like electro or like lead guitar or whatever. And so they start making music together. And so they are trying to navigate what that means, like, because they do fall in love with each other, yeah. but not in the way that we would normally think of. And so to TJ, like, he doesn't know how to process that. And so he tries to do with her the things that I think you would expect to do with a person that you felt like that about, right? That you yeah. were in love with. And then when she rejects him, it confuses both of them because she acknowledges that she doesn't want to do those things with him, but she does love him. So, like, what does that mean? And so it's them trying to navigate that space where, you know, we live in a world where when you see depictions of love in media, it always looks a certain way.
Yep.
And yet they're trying to find their own way through that very different kind of love that feels probably very similar to romantic love. It just isn't the same thing.
Yeah. And I love the words that you're using, different, weird, trouble.
Right.
Yeah. You're like me. You're like a little rebel. What can I do? How can I do this? How can I try this? Right. Like,
yeah.
let me just give it a try. And that. So you've won some awards as well. What kind of awards have you won for your writing?
Yeah. I won several years ago now the Rilla Askew Short Fiction Prize. It's a short story award for, out of a literary magazine called Conclave. That was 2015 or so, something like that.
Congratulations.
And that was cool. And so then I took that's the story that I turned into the play. And then The Smoke in His Eyes has just this past spring, it came in second, it won second prize at the Book Fest for contemporary fantasy. And then it won a third prize in coming of age fiction. At the same
nice yeah. category to be in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So those are the big ones, you know? And of course, like, honestly, I feel like getting anybody to agree to publish anything that you've done is kind of an award in itself. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Because that means that someone there has found some value in it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of people that they just want to have their story heard, right? Just yeah. read and get the feedback.
For sure.
Like, did it change? Did it impact your life? You know, was there a connection? Did it resonate with you?
Yeah.
And that. So what has writing taught you about yourself, Shane?
Well, it has taught me that I am incredibly stubborn. And unwilling to let go of something once I have it in my sights, right? Or once I have an idea that I think is worth pursuing, I will pursue it all the way to the bitter end, even if that means ultimately deciding that it's a no-go, right?
Okay.
If I get an idea for a story, I will write that story out until it either stops coming out of me or it's finished, right? And I think that you have to be a little bit stubborn. I guess a better word for it would be persistent, because it's not easy work to, you know, park it in the chair for hours at a time to essentially do homework. You know, and to invent all of this stuff. And because it's also like, it's also never as easy as just like sitting down and writing at one time, right? Like, we're
right.
writing these things so many times and editing them and revising them and looking at them until we're like, it's the coolest thing I've ever written, but if I have to look at this thing one more time, I'm going to throw it out the window, right?
Right. It's like, oh my God, like, that's just start over. Like,
right. Yeah. And so writing has taught me that, honestly, I think writing has taught me that I have follow through, that I will see an idea out. Cause I think a lot of people have these ideas and I think everybody has a book in them. I just don't think that everybody has the follow through to put it on the page.
Yeah, I agree with that one. I believe everyone has a book in them, but it's meant for some people and not for others, you know?
Right.
And that's okay. why we have different authors and we have different screenplays and directors because,
yeah.
you know, we want to share our stories in different ways. We tell our stories in different ways, right?
Yeah. You know, these questions, what led me to write The Smoke in His Eyes to begin with, right? Because when I wrote A Year Since the Rain and published it, I kind of had that like imposter syndrome thing going on where I was like, who am I to even think that I have anything to say that anybody wants to read about? And that imposter syndrome sort of led me down a line of questioning where I was like, well, what is it about some people? Like, what is it in them that makes them want to create art?
Yeah.
And then beyond that, like the next level of that question is, what is it in a smaller number of those people that make them want to share the things that they create with other people? Like, what is it that drives creation, but also what is it that drives the desire to share what we create? Because it is a very personal endeavor, right? Initially, yeah. at least. And so that Smoke in His Eyes sort of came out of those questions. And in that novel are like three different artists, two musicians and a visual artist. And they all sort of have different reasons for doing the thing that they're doing, you know, and it was a way to sort of, at least for me, work through that line of questioning. I didn't get any answers, but it was still like, I think, a fruitful exercise.
Well, I think when we all try to step out of our comfort zones, right, we all go through that imposter syndrome, like yeah. who's going to listen to this? Who wants to see this? Who's going to read this?
Yeah.
You know, so we have this inner self work with ourselves, and then we're like, well, if we don't try, we won't know, right? We won't know yeah. the outcome.
And I'll tell you, like, I think I've come to the realization, maybe even just right now, Liz, like
he's having epiphany on tea time.
On tea time. And I think it might be that if you ever hit, like, there's value in imposter syndrome, even though it feels bad at the time.
Yes.
And the value is that it means that you're trying something new. And you are pushing yourself beyond the boundaries of what you're comfortable with, because I would hate to think that I, you know, get to the end of my life and look back and all I see are experiences that I was comfortable with from the start, because therein lies stagnation, right?
Yep.
You've got to push yourself into those new arenas in order to grow and evolve as a person. And anything that you do that makes you uncomfortable, maybe you are bad at it. Right. And that's okay too. Like it's okay to be bad at things and it's okay to fail at things.
Well, failing's part of success, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of value in those things and in those feelings.
Yep.
So maybe imposter syndrome isn't all that bad. I'm not saying like, let's everybody go catch a bad case of it.
Everybody go get it.
Right.
But we do need that because we need the balance, right? We need the good and the bad, right? You know, we won't learn anything if we don't try.
I also think that when we feel imposter syndrome, it's interesting because it's on some level, it's an acknowledgement of other people's talent. Those people being so good at what they do is why we feel as new practitioners in yep. a field inferior. And so it's an acknowledgement of other people's talent, which means that we understand that there are people that are better than us, which means that we have identified the people we can learn from. Yeah. And that's another way that imposter syndrome can be positive, because now we know who the teachers are, right? And let's go seek those people out and learn from them so that we can overcome this imposter syndrome.
Right. Well, we need to know what path to take. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like in a fantasy, we need to know what direction to go. Do we go left? Do we go right? You know, if you go left, you're going to be getting this. If you go right, you're getting this. And if you don't get out of your comfort zone, you're not going to grow. You're not going to, you know, and we all have to fall. We all have to break. I tell this to my children all the time. You know, if you don't fall, you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and if you stay in the comfort zone, you're going to live 90 years and say, well, I just lived. Like,
yeah. I would also say that just as an educational practice, we come to recognize what makes something good long yep. before we become good at making that thing ourselves, right? Like I, for many years, knew what I liked about music, right? I could point to certain notes or key changes or vocal things, like I could point to it and I could say, I really like that. That moves me, but yeah. I don't know how to make it happen for myself. Right.
Yeah. I don't know how to get that groove, you know?
Right. Exactly. But now, you know, you just, you, and once you can identify those characteristics of the art that move you or that you want to mimic in some way, or at least like absorb into your own toolbox, then you're really getting somewhere, right? It does. Of course, that means that you're going to feel inferior because that person did it and you don't know how to, but that's the first step in like trying to learn it yourself, right?
Right. Well, it's a curiosity too, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does this person do it? Can I do it?
Yeah.
Can they show me? You know, somebody said, no, YouTube I'm not showing you. So So you mentioned the toolbox. So I think it's a good time to ask you, what is your tea, Shane?
Yeah. So like I was thinking about this earlier and I was trying to figure out what are the things that I, this is, I guess, probably the student in me. I was like, what are the things that I want to touch on? And then what are the words that I can use to make them fit into this acronym? So maybe that's what the way that everybody does it. But for me, the T in T is, it is an acronym, right? Like it's three individual words.
Yes, it is.
It is, for me, the T in T, is try. I have spent my artistic life trying. And what I mean by that is something new comes along that catches my attention, some new form or a collaboration, something else, like whatever. And I see that thing and I am not only interested in it, but I want to try it. And it doesn't always work, right? It doesn't always give me something that is fruitful or positive. But I mean, other than the experience itself, right? Like I'm saying, like it doesn't always yield a product. But it does always yield an experience. And that is in a lot of ways, I think, probably more valuable.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, the T is for try. The E is for educate. I teach college English. So I value education. I think that in teaching what is essentially a communications course at a community college, I'm helping my students sort of learn how to navigate the real world and survive out, and be critically literate citizens, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm also always still learning myself, right? I've never stopped being a student, even though I haven't been taking classes lately. You know what I mean? Like I'm always, like we said, I'm always looking up YouTube videos. How do I get the sound out of my guitar, or how do I, like whatever. So like education is incredibly important. And then the A for me is analysis, because I always want, whenever I create something or whenever I'm working through a process, I'm steadily analyzing it. Is this the most effective way to do it? Is this the best way to do it? Can we do something a little bit differently to get like a different result, right? So like it's, for me, the T is just all about growth and challenge and constant like reassessment of what I'm doing in an attempt to be a more complete person and more complete artist.
Well, and it really aligns, because as a child, you were always trying, you were trying new things and, learning how to tell the story and be the stealth, and then education. Like a teacher, we need the education. And I love that you brought up communication. I want to get into that, because there's a lot of things that I feel that we don't have enough communication. We don't have enough open dialogue. We have all of the short form. Yes, I'm fine. I'm okay.
Right.
But we're not getting into a deep conversation.
Yeah.
So are you finding that as you're teaching your lessons, that communication is lacking in today's world?
Yeah. So this is also, I think, interesting, something that I can probably talk for way longer about than you would care to listen. But I think in short, brevity is kind of a problem. It is. But I think that it's less to do with like how concise communication is becoming and more to do with how sarcastic it's becoming.
Yes.
It's that it's short and sarcastic. I think that's the most damaging part of it. And I'm talking specifically of like a particular brand of meme. I always talk to my students about the memification of information and how a meme, whenever you consume a meme that is meant to inform, it would have you believe that everything you need to know about this particular topic is contained in this square image. And that is just not the case. Much like everything that you need to know about a given topic will never be contained inside of a 30-second TikTok, right?
Yeah.
It's nice to get an introduction there, but you cannot take this as all that you need to know about this information, right? Like this is all icing and no cake, And so I think brevity can be good as long as it acknowledges its own shortcomings and provides a place to go to receive more information about this thing. As long as the brevity or the short conversation, short communication acknowledges that it is just a teaser, right? Like it's just an appetizer.
Yeah.
then I think that
it's just the beginning of the meal. You got to
be productive,
right?
Yeah, but no one should be able to look at 180 characters or 240, however many characters Twitter is now, and think that they know everything about why gas prices are high or whatever. You know what I mean? And I do think that the memification of information and how it's always sarcastic or seemingly mean-spirited also carries over into this like sort of like tribalism that we're starting to see, where people break down into their core groups and they don't talk to people outside of those groups, or they listen to react as opposed to listen to hear. Like these are all sort of like problems that we can address through education. And you know, no one wants to have difficult conversations. They just want to like shout each other down. I try to teach my students that discomfort is okay, right? Like living in those more uncomfortable moments in these conversations can really get us somewhere. If we just spend the rest of our lives taking up extreme positions without listening to someone else's opinion, then we'll never understand where they're coming from or why they think the thing that they think. It's okay to disagree with someone vehemently, but I want to understand why that person believes what they believe, so that way I can better communicate with them, right?
Right. Yeah, I find that the communication is react. There's no listening. There's no understanding. It's all reacting, right? Or it's all like, I know better than you, or I know this more than you. Or like, there's no connection. There's no understanding of one another in a good conversation. And I can talk about this forever because I love deep conversations. And I love getting really deep, deep.
I also try to teach my students or instill in them the value of not only of discomfort, but that that everything is not a competition to be won, right? Like you should not be trying to win a conversation. Like that's not for winning, or like this is not a competition. Like we are just talking to each other. And I think that people, like we're in very like on this group of people sort of culture, you
know, it's almost like a debate, right? Like,
right. Yeah. Everything doesn't have to be a debate. This is a very, and I definitely don't want to get too far into this. It's a very capitalist idea that there has to be a winner in everything. There really doesn't have to be. Sometimes we can just not have any winners. Sometimes it cannot be a competition at all. Right. And I don't even mean like it's a tie. I mean, there wasn't a contest, right? Like we were just talking.
We were just having a conversation.
Right. Because when you start saying, oh, there's not a winner or a loser, then everybody's like, oh, then it was a tie. And I'm like, no, there was no, there wasn't a contest.
Do you do this in your classrooms, like a conversation, like understanding the communication between the difference of a debate and actually just a conversation without I win, you lose?
Yeah, I mean, I talk a lot about that conversation that you've already sort of like lost the point of it if you immediately just take up an extreme stance just to have something to disagree about, right? Like either really believe what you're arguing or discussing, or don't, you know, like don't just say it because you think that that's what you should do. And don't just say it because like you don't like that person or you don't like what that person believes or whatever. Right. To thine own self be true. I always teach this, German philosopher, his name's Jürgen Habermas. He talks about the three conditions for, actual communication. The three conditions are, you must, and he defines communication as the achievement of mutual understanding, which I think is a very good way of defining it, right? Yeah. That means that we both understand the same thing about the thing that we are trying to talk about, right? And so he says that you have to have sincerity, right? You have to believe personally what you're saying. You have to have factuality, which means that what you're saying has to have objective truth to it. And then you also have to have an ethical line of dialogue, right? Which is to say that you're not coercing someone, you're not actively misleading them, et cetera, et cetera. Those three things are sort of like predicated. And of course, like the world is full of people that really, really believe what they have to say, but they may they may not have objective like facts on their side, right? Or they really believe what they have to say. They do have objective facts, but they're trying to insert some sort of power play into the conversation, right? Like, you'll do this if you love me, for example, right? Like, that's coercion. That's not ethical. That sort of stuff, right? So, like, I think that that's a good place to start with a conversation about what communication should look like. And I love the idea that it's the achievement of mutual understanding. It's not just conveying your point to another person. It's mutual understanding.
Yeah. I think that's where it's broken right now. I think we don't have that mutual respect for each other, you know. Right. It's always this, I win, you lose. And, you know, we're not playing games here. We're just having a conversation, right. You know, open dialogue. And, you know, how do you feel about this? And if you don't feel the same as me, well, it's okay. It's a conversation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we'll talk about it. We'll figure that stuff out, right?
Yeah.
But as long as cooler heads prevail, you know, because the other thing that I try to teach my students is that as soon as you've lost your temper, then you... Even if it's
you've already lost.
You've already lost. Yeah.
Yeah. Because your mind is no longer in the conversation. It is just about,
right,
I'm done. You're actually shutting down, right?
Yeah.
So now I want to get into the music.
All right.
So when did you start playing music and how did that all start?
So I started playing. So when I was a kid, I played piano for like 6 months and hated it. I mean, I loved being able to play the piano, but I hated taking lessons and practicing and all of that. So I quit lessons 6 months in. It may be one of the greatest regrets of my life. I do wish that I could like really like tickle the ivories, you know? But alas, I can only kind of like, I can play enough piano now to get myself in trouble.
There's that trouble again.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So for the guitar, I always wanted to play guitar, at least since I was like maybe in college or something. Or maybe even high school. I just always liked it. I liked that idea that someone could like pick up that instrument and make those sounds and make those songs. But I never knew a way to do it. But then I started writing The Smoke in His Eyes. And I wanted it to be about a guitarist. But I also wanted to be able to write about the experience of playing the guitar from a informed place. Like I wanted to be able to talk intelligently about like what the strings feel like under the fingers, what calluses feel like when they form, what the fretboard feels like, you know, as you're moving up and down. What does it mean to tune a guitar? Like all of that. I wanted to understand it so that when I wrote it, if another guitarist were to pick it up, they would be like, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about, right?
Yeah.
And so I bought like a cheap Yamaha guitar from Guitar Center when I started writing that novel and just sort of taught myself to play. Have been playing since then. And I never thought that it would be more than that, right? Like just like, I'm just going to kind of like learn it. Doubt I'll ever play anything. Couldn't get the strumming to make any sense for a long time. And then I read something about it. I watched so many videos about strumming the guitar and I could not make it make sense to me. But then I read an essay about it and it just like kind of like clicked in for me. And so then I went and found an easy song, like a song that was made out of the chords that I knew how to make. And a song that I had heard hundreds of times, you know, and so I knew the rhythm was in me on this like particular song because I'd heard it so much and I knew what it would sound like if I did it right. And so I started playing it and then it all just kind of like locked into place for me. And whenever you put your first song together, it unlocks something in you that is like nothing else. It makes you excited in a new way. Like you want to keep making that stuff, you know. And so I continued to sort of like play a bunch of sort of cover songs for a while, but I wanted to write a song and I wanted to write the song that TJ writes in the book, because I thought it would be really cool to have that come out into the real world. Right.
Yeah.
It'd be something to do at readings. It would make the story, I think, it would give the story more texture if people could like go to a place and hear the song that he wrote. Of course, like the great joke of it all is that this is the masterpiece of TJ's life, the thing that he's worked his entire life to like try to write. And then I wrote this as my very first song ever. So it's probably the most elementary thing anyone's ever done. But still, like, it is what it is. It's called Before We Fade Away. And it's a song that I'm still like pretty proud of. I put it on. I had a little band for a little while called Sequoia Rising. Is just a two-man acoustic outfit, acoustic guitar and some percussion. And we released an album. It was like March of 2021.
Oh, okay.
I think something like that. I recorded it all myself. I played all the instruments on it. I did it during lockdown. That's what I sort of like poured myself into whenever we first shut things down for COVID. And so I recorded it all myself and then got it mixed and everything. I don't actually really know when it came out. I think maybe actually February of 21, but whatever. It's called Of All the Things I've Ever Said, I Mean This the Most.
Oh, I love the title.
Yeah, it's a killer title. I was pretty proud of it because I don't know if you can tell, but I say a lot of things. And I felt like that title was appropriately wordy, but also it carried some weight because I say so much, but like this, I mean this stuff the most, you know?
Yeah.
It's like a collection of like sort of confessional, like acoustic ballads, narrative sort of work. There's a song about Amy Winehouse on there. There's, you know, a song about like a jerk at a bar. There's, you know, but then there's a lot of like sort of soft, like love stuff on there too, you know?
So could we get a couple songs from you?
Yeah, we can do a couple of songs. I haven't played a couple of these songs in a little while, but we'll see. We'll see what it sounds like for you. If you decide that it doesn't sound too good, then we'll do something else. How do we feel about that? Do we need
you sound good
more of something and less of something else? So nope. I'll do.
Sounds good.
Cool. I'm gonna do Before We Fade Away. This is a song that the very first song I ever wrote, and this is for it was for the novel, right? So Before We Fade Away.
Came in like a wrecking ball. You tore down my walls when we collided. You're going out like a candle, just a whisper of smoke in the night. The way that you have talked to me has changed. Your eyes dart around the room. I don't know what you're looking for, but I'm worried that you'll find it soon. Please let me hold you one last time before we fade away. Please let me look into your eyes one last time before you go.
I just broke a string.
Oh. Only on tea time.
Right, only on tea time. I should have known that it would. Let me grab the other one. Hold on. We got a backup.
That's all. We always need a backup, right? And that's how it is on tea time. So for any of the viewers and listeners that are watching now and watching the replay, just let me know where you're tuning in, because I always love to hear where you're tuning in from. And if you'd like to know more on Shane, you can check out his website. It is here. And in the audio part, it will be in the description, so you can find all that incredible stuff there. And we will continue to jam a little bit with some tea.
Should've known that it would end like this tonight. You're packing up your things. You're faded out into the darkness while I'm feeling silence with guitar strings. You are not something that can be contained. Please let me hold you one last time before we fade away. Please let me look into your eyes one last time before you go. Thank you. I still feel you in this place. Your smell lingers in the room. This bed is just too big tonight. My hands go searching for you. Please let me hold you one last time before we fade away. Please let me look into your eyes one last time before you go. You are not something that can be contained.
Or something like that.
Awesome, awesome. So
sorry for the string break right in the middle.
Only on tea time. Every time.
We just jump right back into it there.
Well, that's it, right? We just keep pouring. Spilling.
That's right.
So do you have one more song for us, Shane, before we wrap up?
Yeah, let's see. Let's think about it really quick. Let me see if I can. No, I definitely haven't played this one in a minute, so let's hope for the best.
Oh, so it's an oldie.
All right.
Tonight I'll probably get drunk again. Just like we used to. Well, it's been easier but less fun in the 2 weeks that I've been gone. Tonight I'll probably get sloppy again and turn the wall into the floor. Wake up feeling a little like death. Your voice ringing in my head. But tonight I'll ask the whiskey to let me dream where you are back east, where the mountains turn into the sand hills. I'll dream you're waiting there for me. Tonight I'm reading your letters, every single thing you've sent, and I'm listening to your voice on old tapes, try to find some way to repent. But tonight I'll ask the whiskey to let me dream where you are back east, where the mountains turn into the sand hills. I'll dream you're waiting there for me. And tomorrow I'll drive my car down a winding mountain highways, and I'll be there when you get home from work. Just hoping that you'll let me stay. But tonight I'll ask the whiskey to let me dream where you are back east, where the mountains turn into the sand hills. I'll dream you're waiting there for me. Yeah, tonight I'll ask the whiskey to let me dream where you are back east, where the mountains turn into the sand hills. I'll dream you're waiting there for me. Tonight I'll ask the whiskey.
Awesome. So before we wrap up your tea time, Shane, any final words that you have for the listeners and viewers out there?
Oh, you know what? I guess just I mean, look, like I just play the guitar here for you guys, right? And like, I'm no professional. So I think it all just goes back to try, right? Because you'll always come out with something on the other side that you can be proud of, even if nobody else cares, right? And that's really what we do it for, right? Is like, is to extract something out of ourselves. And sometimes that's in a story, and sometimes that's in a song or a poem or whatever. Like the stories will find you if you allow them the room. So just give it a try.
I love it. I love it. And that's what we're doing here, right? Is we're trying and we're spilling tea. We're bringing music. We're bringing storytelling. We're bringing communication, dialogue, a good old conversation. So I want to thank you, Shane, for joining me for tea today and sharing your tea, because you did share a strong tea. So try, educate, and analysis, yeah. I believe.
Or
right?
Analyze, if you really
analyze.
Want to
keep it
there on, we go. Keep it on point there.
Well, two strong A words, right? That we need to be speaking more of in that. So I want to really thank you for joining me today on Tea Time.
Absolutely.
And I will see everyone back on, let me see, August 28th at 3 p.m. And I have Kelly Brackhoff coming in, and she'll be sharing on sign language, American Sign Language. So we'll be doing some sign language that day. There's always a different tea, always a different blend, always a different flavor that comes to the table. And if one tea doesn't resonate, the next one will. And it's like Shane said, we got to try. You know, if we don't try, we don't know. And Shane, I really want to thank you for sharing those two amazing songs. And I'm sorry for the guitar string.
Oh, hey, it's okay. It's not your fault, I promise. I probably should have changed it a long time ago.
But I really enjoyed sitting down and having tea with you today. And that, and I want to put a special shout out to Mickey Mickelson, who has been giving me these incredible guests and working with me, collaborating and bringing strong teas to the table. So again, thank you to Mickey from Creative Edge for giving me Shane and Kelly and all the other incredible guests that have come on Tea Time. Shane, is there anywhere where they can find the books before we wrap up?
Yeah, actually, you can find everything Shane Wilson over at ShaneWilsonAuthor.com. That'll be the books, the music, the whole shebang will be over there.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Thank you so much. And I want to put a shout out to Dr. Teresa Morley for joining us today in the studio. Thank you. And check her out. She has a book coming up. So she will be maybe a guest in 2023, because Miss Liz is fully booked for the year. So Shane, we have a couple seconds left. I want to run it right to the hour because I want to give you your full hour.
Okay.
So any last words for the students out there that are into storytelling or music or anything that you have for them?
Yeah. Find a way. Listen, if you're a student, especially, the educational enterprise will do its best to get you to not like writing. It has sort of over institutionalized the practice. It will make you do a bunch of research papers and a bunch of stuff that feels completely disconnected from the real world and also from your own personal passions. Don't let that get you down. There's good writing to be had. There's good stuff to read. It doesn't all have to be boring and dry. You can absolutely find yourself a good mentor that is willing to work with you on the things that you want to work on. And then, you know, like do the things you have to do to get the grade, right? But then really focus on the things that you're passionate about.
Awesome. And for all of your students out there, can they check out this Tea Time? Can they give a little high five or something? I'd like a little shout out, maybe a little video or something saying way to go.
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe we'll see. We will see, I suppose.
Awesome. 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 Thank you so much, Shane.
Absolutely.
Thank and you, thank Liz. You to all the viewers and listeners who tuned in. And if you're watching a replay, please let Miss Liz know where you're tuning in from. I always like to know where my listeners are coming in from. And if you like a topic and you want more of it, please reach out and let me know as well. And you can find everything on www.MissLiz'sTeaParties.com. All of the podcasts are there as well, so you can find them there. And if you'd like to listen to the audio, you can find me on 24 different platforms. And I'm all over. So if you want to check out and get these tea times and you think that you can't find them, you will be able to find them. And again, a special shout out to Creative Edge for all of these incredible guests. And I do want to put another shout out to Mental Health Warriors. Check out that they have a show as well, to bring awareness to mental health, because we do need to bring awareness to mental health and stay connected in that. And I will see everybody August 28 at 3 p.m. with Kelly for American Sign Language. Thank you, guys.